Last week in my sermon, I mentioned an article that I had read last week, not by way of preparing the sermon, but because it interested me from an old issue of the Anglican Theological Review, and it was called Spiritual, but Not Religious. And I have to tell you, since I've been at St. Luke's, which is a fair amount of time now, if I've had somebody say that to me once, I've had them say it to me a gazillion times. You know, it's the new thing with regard to spirituality and religion. And I got to thinking that the Green Sundays, I always say, are about discipleship, the cost, the ways and the means, the nature. It's also a time for the church to teach during the Green Sundays about themes and ways of being that are part of our common life together. In other words, about the tradition with a capital T. And so the reading from 2 Timothy is about the apostolic succession. It's about the structure of the church in some ways. And I thought I'd say some things about that. And then I'd try to relate it. You know, I'm operating on the Ralph Cramden principle with Ed Norton and putting the square peg in the round hole. And when Ralph Cramden said, "It will fit if you force it." That's what I'm doing. Or at least some of you may think so. But the fact of the matter is that the issue of spiritual and religious as being somehow polar opposites or opposed to one another is an issue. And it's important for people who've been longtime Episcopalians or perhaps in a generation different than the ones that are beginning now to take the reins of power, Gen X, Gen Y, and who think about spirituality as being authentic and religion as being hypocritical. And so how can the church speak with some content, some coherence, and bring to the spiritual yearning of people some kind of way of thinking and relating that is congruent with the tradition with the capital T, but also sensitive to the issues that create that kind of outlook? There's a phenomenon that's been going on for a while now in American Christianity. It's called the emerging church or the emergent church. It depends on who you talk to about this sort of thing. And one of the things that probably helps to understand this phenomenon is postmodernity, which sounds kind of highfalutin, but postmodernity is here with us. And it behooves everybody to become something of a student of what it is. One of the features, nobody agrees about exactly what postmodernity is. But I would say that postmodernity is characterized by most people who are postmodern, whether they know it or not, by what is called a hermeneutic of suspicion. All of the old ways of thinking are suspect. And so in some way it's the individual's responsibility to create a way of being and relating. Spirituality focuses itself for many people on our interior life, our emotional, spiritual, and mental states. And religion seems to be a lot of shoulds and a lot of things that don't seem to have any meaning. But here's the interesting thing. In the emergent church, what you begin to see now is the recovery of, or the interest at the very least, in traditional practice. You know? So you'll be treated to something in a bulletin like, "Well, we've just discovered this long abandoned practice that we're going to do today, which is we're all going to stand up and say the Nicene Creed together." Right? Well, Episcopalians have been saying the Nicene Creed together for a long time. And so perhaps the contribution that we can make to this enterprise is to bring some sort of shape to a new way of thinking about Christian practice. I want to make a commercial message for the importance and the power, the staying power of religion. Religion involves practices and beliefs. And religion is not just inward, it is also outward. And to some degree, that is what Paul, or perhaps the disciple who wrote 2 Timothy, one of his heirs, was getting at when he wrote to Timothy. So here's some important background about all of this. I think if you read this epistle carefully, you'll see that Timothy maybe has been suffering from a failure of nerve, or he is being ground down by his responsibilities. Paul ordained Timothy. And in this reading, you will see that he received this charismata from Paul's laying on of hands. Now, what's interesting about this from the tradition point of view, with a capital T, is we're now moving into something in history called the sub-apostolic age. So most of the apostles are dead. So what we've got now are the successors to the apostles that have become the successors to the apostles through a process of the laying on of hands and some kind of liturgical rite, R-I-T-E. Here's something you should know about the early church from the jump. Three things began to emerge in the second century, in this order. The episcopate, bishops, first. Second, the Apostles' Creed, or its precursor, a baptismal creed. And third, last, the canon of the Holy Scriptures. So by the 200s, we begin to see these things pretty well in place. And in Timothy, one of the reasons that they believe it's Deuteropauline is that it clearly expresses a whole way of being church that is fairly formed. It has bishops, priests, and deacons. It has traces of the baptismal liturgy and the creed. And we begin to see emerging from this then some sacred literature which is being recognized and formed in the various Christian churches. So Paul is saying to Timothy that he needs to remember that what he received. He needs to be reminded of what he did this for in the first place. Timothy's a very interesting person because he had one Jewish parent and one Gentile parent. And so he sort of embodies in himself that tension that exists within the Christianity of that era, as Judaism and Christianity were beginning now to do this. And being a disciple of Paul, he would say, I understand Paul's Jewishness because of my background, and I understand through his own conversion experience why he felt compelled to be a missionary to the Gentiles. To say to them that by virtue of Jesus Christ, we have seen a living example of God's plan for the cosmos, which is that this message is not just for the people of the covenant. God's saving embrace is for everyone, the Gentiles too. And so God's message of radical inclusion, which is not just something I'm saying because I'm here now as an apostle, but is in direct continuity with all of the sacred literature of our people, if we had just read it and seen it this way and understood what the great prophets of Israel were saying, that we would see now that this is part of the plan of God and that we wish to be an instrument of this process of bringing to completion and fullness and wholeness and healing the whole of the cosmos. Remember that in the Hebrew Bible and in the Greek New Testament, the same word that is used for to save means to heal. And so when we understand the processes by which God is at work, we begin to see that our internal spiritual condition also needs to become now expressed in religious terms. And we see the beginning of this in this letter from to 2 Timothy. So it's an important thing to remember in that regard. Maybe religion is important. Just so you know, post-modernity comes probably out of what some scholars call the Second Romantic Movement, which locates itself in our country in the my generation of the late 60s and 70s. And it has a direct relationship with the first Romantic movement, you know, like Goethe and Rousseau and all of those people. And the way they looked at it was, it seemed to be always more interesting to find out what was obscure and hidden and esoteric as opposed to what in fact is known and is, you know, sort of the same old, same old. And so you and I have a task in front of us, because Paul is at pains with Timothy to say, you know what, you need to in some way understand what it is that made you want to do this in the first place. You need to be given the strength and the stamina to be able to meet the challenges and the opportunities in front of you. And how do you get that? Well, first of all, as a member of the community of the baptized, you get it through the Spirit of God, which you received at your baptism. God coming in an inward way to enlighten and strengthen you. And since you now have been called to the ordained ministry, that Spirit of God is present to you now in a life of self-giving and service, in maintaining your prophetic edge, in learning how to in some way create the internal strength and stamina to meet the resistance that you receive when people are anxious. I don't know about you all, but you know, whenever I meet resistance, I doubt myself. That's the first thing. Somebody says, yeah, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I go, well, maybe I shouldn't have said it. Right? So how do you maintain the courage of your convictions? How do you maintain the prophetic edge? You know, the prophetic edge doesn't mean you're a pain in the neck and you're on the sidewalk with a placard. It often means that you're willing to speak the truth to power, that you're to live a life of integrity and witness in the midst of your business, in the midst of your family, in the midst of all the things that we do in a regular, ordinary, and commonplace way. I say this over and over again. I think, you know, we're just too connected to the idea that we have to do this in heroic terms all the time. It has to look like a lot of Sturm und Drang, you know, for it to be authentic. When in fact, it just needs to be you, the best human being that you can be, unconditionally loved, accepted, and forgiven by God. That is the heart of the message of the gospel of Christ. Now, somebody who works on their interior life for a long time can receive some level of balance and serenity. There's no doubt about it. I've mentioned this to you before. One of the best descriptions of an individual who did that was by the Bishop of Alexandria in the 4th century, a guy named Athanasius. And he wrote a biography of a spiritual master who lived in the 3rd century, 4th century, named Anthony. Saint Anthony of the desert. He ran off in Egypt into the desert and lived as a recluse, as a hermit, for 25 years in a cave. Now, people would come and see him from time to time, you know, and he'd sort of dispense. But he was by himself mainly. And after 25 years, the rumor circulated that Anthony was going to come out of his cave. And so a huge number of people came to the cave to see Anthony come out. They didn't all go, "Oh, come out, Anthony." Well, they didn't do that. They just were sort of waiting. And he comes out. And in Athanasius's description, he says, Anthony comes out of the cave. Here's a man who has lived by himself with God for 25 years. He did not look wasted by hair-raising austerities. He didn't look particularly happy to see us. He didn't look particularly upset that we were there. He was a man completely at home with himself. Boy, I hope somebody can say that about me someday. It isn't true yet. That's what spiritual centeredness is. It isn't, though, a continuous life of focusing on the interior states. And even Anthony and the spiritual masters would say, this isn't the life for everybody by any stretch of the imagination. You know? I just heard an interview with the Dalai Lama about 6 weeks ago where he said, you know, I got a lot of Christian people who come to me and talk to me about wanting to be a Buddhist. Or wait, don't do that. Don't do that. Practice your Christianity. Learn the religious practices, the intentions. That's what you should do. You know? But to my generation, we all want to go to Tibet and Om for peace. You know? Maybe some should do that. I don't know. But we have a very deep and a very wide spiritual tradition in Christianity. It's the fault of the leadership of the church for many, many centuries, probably, both lay and ordained, that they have not focused attention on the deep spiritual well that is within our tradition. And so we discover then that spirituality and religion are not opposed. Thomas Merton, the great writer on the spiritual life in the 20th century, in this country, in the West, one of them. The spiritual life is the whole of life, body, soul, mind, spirit, given to God in love. So spirituality is life. Some of the things we learn about religious practice and about who we are as Christian people require us occasionally to listen to hard sayings. And in the gospel for today, Jesus is letting none of the apostles, as it says, off the hook. First of all, they ask him to increase our faith. This is the classic question that other people ask all the time. Don't we believe always or often that there's something outside ourselves that's going to fix us? If we just had that, we'd be fine, right? Well, most of spiritual centeredness and most of faith is an inside job, learning how to do that. Jesus said, apparently, it's kind of a rebuke. If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, he then gives an absurd example of what could be accomplished through this kind of faith. But then he says, because of who they are as apostles, that they should understand in this question that he asked them as being in the position of the slaves that he described. The slaves are working in the field. You're the master. You say when they come back, oh, sit down and have your dinner. You don't do that. You tell your slaves to cook the dinner for me. Then you eat. And after you've cooked the dinner, the slaves say, well, we are only unworthy slaves. I suppose people at home who have the major responsibility for cooking would sympathize with that outlook, right? I'll tell you, this is a personal story. I do most of the cooking at home. I love to cook. I've been interested in it for a long time. My youngest son is a chef, and he got it from me. The fact of the matter is, I learned something I would have never learned. Something that the women in my family used to say about this being an act of love. It doesn't always feel that way, for sure. I guess the other reason why I started getting interested in this is that when I was in my teens, I thought cooking was a great mystery. It was something that just got done. And I thought, how do you do, you know, how is that done? And then I discovered it isn't as mysterious as people think that it is. That's the truth. But you also learn something about what the Savior says when you say, we are unworthy slaves, we're just doing what we're supposed to do. You've agreed to do this, and you do it. So in some way, it is the acceptance of what it is you said you were going to do. This is a little bit complicated because in the New Revised Standard Version, they have correctly translated the Greek and say slave. In the other translations, it's servant. But doulos is slave. And the purpose of doing that is to say, what was the world like when Jesus was alive? And it meant that in households, there are a lot of people who were living there as slaves, and they were doing all, taking care of the kids, doing the cooking, working in the fields, and so forth. That's how it was understood, sort of the world as it was. But be that as it may, Jesus isn't letting anybody off the hook. Christian people are called to be self-giving. Christian people are called to be generous. Christian people are called to maintain their prophetic edge in a world that needs to hear these words. We sometimes need to speak the truth to power, and it's important that we steel ourselves to do that and know that God is always with us, the Spirit of God, God coming in an inward way to enlighten and strengthen us. So this week, think about your vocation. Think about your life. Think about where you need a little boost, because it's the same old, same old. Remember that God's Spirit is present to you even if you don't feel it, to enlighten and strengthen you. That God has a plan for you in big and small ways as part of His purpose for the cosmos, and that you are essential to it. Amen.